This is The Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. This week, Bill and Phil break down the Supreme Court ruling on birthright citizenship, and then think through the future of the Democratic Party on the one-year anniversary of Joe Biden's disastrous debate. Now let's go to the lab.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Politics Lab. My name is Bill Muck, and I'm a professor of political science at North Central College. And I am joined by my colleague and best friend, Phil Barker, who is a professor of political science at Keene State College. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. We are recording one day before you fly off to Alaska for like a major cruise and exploring the hinterland edition.
Yeah, it's going to be, there's probably going to be whittling involved and lots of jerky.
Yes. Bears and salmon. It's great. You're doing a cruise through you're going to be in Denali National Park and then going up and down the coast. And that'll be a real outdoorsy experience. Now, you're going to be enjoying a lot of it from a boat, but you're still there.
That boat's going to go into the real pretty places. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. I haven't been on a cruise since I was like a kid. I guess that's not true. It's been 20 years since I've been on a cruise. So I'll be interested to see. I don't know. I don't really know what to expect, but I have high expectations for Alaska. I hear nothing but amazing things from anybody who's ever been there. So that'll be lovely, I think.
Oh, it'll be great. And so our listeners should know we won't be recording next week because Phil will be wrestling a bear in Alaska somewhere. So, but we'll be back in 2 weeks. And I can't imagine anything big will happen. You know, like it's not like there's a lot of developments occurring. Hopefully there'll be no more conversation about the big, beautiful bill. That we may touch a little bit on that. But Phil and I were both saying that there's almost like a fatigue and exhaustion with this legislation. And I don't know, I personally have been, it's hard to be engaged by it because there's so much that troubles me about what's happening. Yep. But I think I'm guessing that's going to wrap up in the next couple of days.
Yeah, I mean, we should say it's a disaster, right? I mean, all the economic analysis says it's going to be, you know, awful for the economy and for the debt and all sorts of other stuff, that it, you know, unevenly benefits the wealthiest Americans by a lot. It cuts social programs. Like it's not good.
And it's been interesting to watch Republicans, who a lot of Republicans get this is not a good piece of legislation, but are feeling the pressure from the president and either getting in line or resigning, or not, I shouldn't say resigning, or saying they're not going to run for re-election. Tom Tillis and others have expressed some concern. Trump has gone after them, and they've suddenly decided they're not going to run for re-election. So there really is not a lot of space in the Republican Party for dissension. You get in line or you think about another career choice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the biggest dissent is coming from like the most conservative Republicans, it seems like, right? I mean, they're the ones that are now, and they're basically saying that the bill doesn't go far enough in essentially making cuts, right? That if you're fiscally conservative and you're worried about the debt, then they're not saying we shouldn't cut taxes this much. They're just saying we need to slash social programs even more, basically. So,
right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, this, you know, some of the numbers you're seeing is that over the next decade, this bill is going to add $4 trillion to the national debt. And, you know, I think both parties are less concerned with the national debt now than they might have been 25 years ago. But Republicans are supposed to be the ones that are fiscally responsible, and they have abandoned all of those ambitions or goals, I guess, because this is pretty dramatic, bigger than all of the recent Democratic legislation that came under Biden and Obama. Yeah.
By a lot. And you know, yes, the Democrats and Republicans are less concerned with the deficit now than they were 25 years ago, but they should be, if anything, more concerned, right? I mean, the deficits become, there's all sorts of writing on how you shouldn't be that worried about deficits. Deficit spending in government is largely okay, but we're getting to the point where it's, you know, all the estimates are showing it's going to have major impacts in the long term on global American economic growth and all sorts of other things. So
it has become a huge chunk of the U.S. annual budget, right? Yeah. You're servicing that debt. And exactly, you know, when the U.S. economy is so big, a lot of economists have said, well, debt isn't a huge issue, but we're now getting to the point where we're going the wrong direction. We're not thinking about more sensible choices. We're actually expanding it. And again, there's always the desire for tax cuts because those are politically people like that, right? Yep. But when you cut taxes, I mean, you have to either reduce spending or something, right? I mean, I don't know. We've had had this wave of cutting taxes over the last few decades, never raising taxes, and we spend more. So that it's a recipe for bad budgetary governance, Phil.
It's almost like American politics is dysfunctional.
Yes, that's right. Yes. So all of that's going on. But today we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the major decisions out of the Supreme Court, and also then dive into this bigger picture that Phil and I have been thinking about for probably the last month or so. But there's been so much chaos every week in which we come to podcasts that we haven't been able to deal with it. But thinking more long term, where does the Democratic Party need to go? What are some big changes? And we thought the anniversary of the debacle of a debate that was Joe Biden versus Donald Trump might be a good launching point for a conversation about all of that. Well, before we dive into the Supreme Court, though, Phil, remind everybody how they can stay connected with us.
Yeah, so go to thepoliticslab.com. You can find all the information on the podcast. You can find all our episodes, and each episode has relevant readings. And so this week, when we talk about the future of the Democratic Party, there's a New York Times did a really interesting analysis of electoral shifts. There's a David Brooks piece that gets in that we'll probably talk about some, an Ann Applebaum piece from The Atlantic. So I'll put a lot of that up. And then for the Supreme Court stuff, particularly the SCOTUS, the birthright citizenship stuff, there was an interesting analysis from the New York Times that gets into some of the implications. I'll put that up as well. So all of that you can find at thepoliticslab.com. Just go there and click on this week's episode and read to your little heart's content.
That is good. You'll have a little extra reading because you got next week off. So set aside some time for the deep reading. So, all right, let's start with birthright citizenship. Phil, maybe a good place to begin is to kind of walk the listeners through what happened, because there's really two conversations. One is about the issue of the birthright citizenship. Donald Trump had an executive order where he said that the 14th Amendment, which says that if you're born in the United States, you get citizenship, is in fact not correct, and that you should. That this is a travesty and not what the founders, what the people who wrote the 14th Amendment meant, and that we should end birthright citizenship. But it also gets to this issue of jurisdiction of federal judges, and that in some ways is the deeper issue than the other one. But why don't you start by walking us through a little bit of what we learned from the court on all of this?
Well, I mean, so this decision that was handed down by the Supreme Court this last week didn't actually touch on the sort of substantive issue of birthright citizenship. Right? So the question of whether or not the president can actually undo birthright citizenship, particularly through an executive order, has not actually been decided. What this case dealt with was just the power of judges to issue, whether or not judges should be allowed to issue nationwide injunctions. So what happened was the birthright order comes down from the Trump administration. There were legal challenges all over the place, and a number of judges issued injunctions that stopped this birthright citizenship, the enforcement of this executive order, but they the rulings enforced it, put the injunction in place nationwide. And so the question was, and this has been sort of one of the beefs of conservatives for a while, is that you have, you know, quote unquote activist judges who are stepping beyond the bounds of what they should be able to do. So really this question was less about birthright citizenship, this particular decision, and was more about the power of the courts to check the president. And so what the courts basically, what the Supreme Court ruled was they sided with the Trump administration and said that judges can't issue these nationwide injunctions. They can basically limit the enforcement of this executive order within essentially their specific jurisdiction. But that's it. So now we have this weird situation where there are states where this executive order banning birthright citizenship are basically still in effect, and other states where they're not. And I don't, is it a good thing? Is it a normal thing to have like inconsistent citizenship rules across a country, Bill? Is that something that happens in other countries?
It can be a little messy, right? Because I think 22 largely blue states brought this case.
Yep.
And again, my understanding is that judge's ruling still applies for those 22 blue states. However, the other red states who are not party of this, there's a very different ruling, right? Now, I think the court said there's 30 days to kind of think through all of this to let some of the courts process it. But yeah, it creates a wide inconsistency. And the Supreme Court, or the 6-3 majority, argued that, well, this is necessary to pull some of the power back from these federal judges and then rest all of that power with the Supreme Court. So it ultimately should be the Supreme Court making all of these decisions, which is sort of an interesting power grab by the Supreme Court. Because in what some ways they are giving the executive, the president, a tremendous amount of power, and they're giving themselves a lot of power, and then sort of shredding the federal judiciary as a whole and just saying, like, it's either the president or it's us, and that's it. And that has a huge ripple effect.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that, like, this is, it's not that the Supreme Court couldn't rule on this, but I mean, so that basically what this is doing is setting it up that this has to go on appeal. And the court has basically said that you can put together class action lawsuits and stuff like that. And so that's what groups have started doing. But that was kind of, I mean, again, like, this could have gone on appeal. This is what happened here, right? Like, I mean, the purpose of this sort of nationwide injunction is to basically allow it to be sort of teed up for higher courts to make the decision. And now what the court's basically doing is, you know, hamstringing the court's ability, the lower court's abilities to actually kind of put a pause on things. So you're right. It is this. And again, we've talked a lot about, like, the shift in the Republican Party away from this, like, small government approach to this, like, centralized government approach, right? This is really kind of that pendulum swing from essentially the courts have been on the side, have largely been kind of for the past, you know, whatever, 60 years, have been more liberal in, you know, broadly speaking. And so this is part of that big push to kind of rein that in. And it feels like this is more an attack on the courts than it is sort of anything else. It feels like this is a, you know, something that conservatives have wanted for a long time. But it also feels like so many of these other decisions where the Supreme Court it feels like they have this sort of narrow thing they're trying to achieve. You think about the presidential immunity one, right? Like, it feels like they didn't want to, like, all out say the president couldn't, you know, do this stuff. But the implications of being unwilling to actually think broadly about what you're doing, like, the implications of that more narrow decision are massive. And it feels like the same thing here, right? Like, it feels like they're saying we need to, you know, swat down these activist lower courts, but without thinking through what that means, like, all the mess that's going to cause now by ruling against the courts here.
It's really interesting because there's a number of other ways they could have proceeded. I mean, they could have. Well, the first thing is that this is such an absurd case, right? The idea that the president can simply write away the Constitution through an executive order. In my estimation, what they should have done is said, this is an incredibly stupid case. Obviously, the 14th Amendment grants birthright citizenship. We're not going to entertain this question of judge shopping. Now, we're going to wait for a better case, which they oftentimes do. But it is clear that they wanted to have this conversation. And I think they maybe also want to have the birthright citizenship conversation. So that's bad. But oftentimes what we see the court doing is saying this isn't something for the courts to do. This is something for Congress. And they could have easily fixed this by saying, hey, if you're upset with both liberal and conservative groups judge shopping, trying to find a judge, a liberal or conservative judge, who would overturn, an executive order, then let Congress pass some sort of law that says there's a random process. You can't just go to some jurisdiction and say, this judge is likely to rule with us. Make them go through a random process where you don't know what judge you're going to get. That solves all of this, right? And in some ways, that's the better procedure to say, hey, we're not going to micromanage this. We're going to let Congress do it, which is something they do all of the time, except for
when
some
it's
of these issues
for them. Yes. When it benefits them, this is Congress's decision. When it doesn't, it's our decision. Yep.
Right. It's a little demoralizing because these cases, I mean, last you'd mentioned the immunity decision. Like, 5 years ago, I couldn't have imagined that the Supreme Court said, yes, the president is immune to basically anything he does within the purview of his office. And I couldn't imagine the same thing that, you know, 5 years ago that the court would say, we're going to entertain the idea that the president can overturn the 14th Amendment by executive order. And again, that you're right, they haven't fully done that, but they should have shut this conversation down immediately to say, hey, we're willing to think about this issue of federal injunctions, and there are some concerns. And again, there are both liberal and conservative concerns here, where this you know hits both parties, but not in this stupid case. And it's frustrating that they're doing that.
It feels like they wanted the chance to basically strike back against the courts, and so yes, they're taking it and then punting on the actual substantive part. Do you feel confident that they will? I mean, it does feel like this is obviously an open shut case, right? Like this is but. I don't know that anything's open and shut with the Supreme Court anymore. When it makes it back to the Supreme Court for the substantive part, there's at least two Supreme Court justices who are going to side with Trump on this. At least two, right?
I have to think so. If the court is going to stand for anything when it comes to textualism or originalism, like I have to feel at some point that the court says, no, you can't overturn birthright citizenship. But I don't know what kind of world we're living in, because you're right. Alito and Thomas certainly will entertain this. But that's such a big deal. I mean, so, you know, the originalists say, what was the original intent of those who wrote it? It's very clear. And the legal scholars are all on one side of this. The text itself is also very, very clear. And Trump's legal argument is basically that, well, those who wrote the 14th Amendment only were thinking about the children of slaves. And like, no, that's a piece of legislation. That's not a constitutional amendment. When you do that, you're thinking about the long-term implications. So yeah. I hope that this is untouchable, but I thought the immunity issue was untouchable. So I who knows anymore? I'm deeply worried about that. I think if they ultimately rule that he has the right to overturn birthright citizenship, I don't know what sort of democracy we have left. That means the courts have gone full Venezuelan model. Right?
Yep,
it's
for sure.
Really, really disturbing.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, should we shift gears and talk a little bit about the future of the Democratic Party here?
Let's do it.
All right. So you and I have been taught, you in particular, have been thinking for like a month now about what comes next for the Democratic Party. There's been lots of discussion and debate within the party about what comes next. I don't know if listeners are aware of this, but there's been this kind of whole infighting about why my brain just went blank. Why? What's the name for the school of thought that
the abundance agenda?
The abundance agenda. There you go. So the abundance agenda has been a big thing. There's been a number of books about it, and really
Ezra Klein being sort of the leading voice in that movement, the idea that if Democrats got to win or want to win, they need to come up with an economic model and a way of providing for people, and then they'll come back.
Yeah. So you sent me this really interesting tweet today about how from the New York Times about like the number of articles that have mentioned like what the Democrats should do or the Democrats have to do. And it's been like thousands in the last couple of months that have touched on this issue. So there's this big debate about what, you know, it follows from the kind of postmortem, right? Like what went wrong? Was it Joe Biden's fault? Was it Kamala Harris's fault? Was it the party's fault? Was this, did the party do something wrong? Or are they just out of sync with the American people? And so this debate has come up about, does the party need to rethink what it's doing? This abundance agenda basically says it needs to go back to this notion of pursuing policies that are beneficial to, you know, kind of working class and lower class Americans. There are others that say that, you know, the Democratic Party needs to, you know, sort of continue to or go back to what was working with it, working for it in the past in terms of focusing more on the marginalized groups in America. So this is really kind of an interesting question. And I don't know that anybody has the answer, but it'll be fun to kind of think through this. I mean, what do you like when you look at all of this, like where? You know, you mentioned we're doing this on the 1 year anniversary of Joe Biden's, right. You know, the beginning of the sort of collapse. Maybe the beginning was long before that. But, you know, how do you want to approach this?
Well, yeah, I think maybe starting with that Joe Biden moment, right? Think about like it to me, in some ways, it feels like that was years and years ago, that debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, where, I mean, I'm guessing, do you remember where you were at that moment, where you were watching that debate?
Yes, I remember you texting me and being like, this is bad. This is a disaster. Yeah,
same thing. Like, I'm guessing a lot of Democrats who are, well, absolutely right. I mean, I remember we were watching it at home, and my son and I were watching it on the couch, and Joe Biden came out and looked not good. I mean, he just sort of looked weak. And then he started talking, and both of us looked at each other and thought, oh no. And it just, it spiraled. I mean, it will go down in history likely as the worst debate performance maybe in U.S. political history. And I think it's a really interesting marker to think about where the Democratic Party was 5 minutes before Joe Biden starts that debate and where we are today. Because I don't think we could have fully imagined the evolution, the revolution that has occurred in U.S. politics where, I mean, Donald Trump is in an extraordinarily strong position. He is in full control of the Republican Party. Yeah. The party no longer really stands for any ideological positions outside of what Donald Trump feels and temporarily believes in. And so now the Democrats face this position of, what do you do? And then, as you mentioned, sort of this post-mortem, there are these really interesting questions about where does the problem lie? Does it lie with the party itself, right? Have the Democrats made poor decisions? Have they been too woke, too tied to the interests of marginalized communities? Do they need to become more centrist? Or is it a broader dynamic where the world and U.S. politics has been caught up in this wave of populism and that the Democrats need to just simply adapt to the global movement, revolutionary movement that's playing out? And I think we've seen, like you noted, like thousands and thousands of pieces being written, thinking about where the Democratic Party needs to be. And it's a pretty extraordinary moment. And I think there are no answers, right? I don't think Ezra Klein's abundance agenda is necessarily like clearly the right answer. I don't think running away from the so-called woke agenda is necessarily the answer. I think Democrats are just sort of treading water, hoping to figure out how do they move forward. What's your sense of sort of like this last year in Democratic politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the way to think of it. I don't know. As I look back at it, I think we're at this really kind of sort of monumental sort of turning point in American politics. And I think these happen, right, where you have these sort of electoral realignments. And Donald Trump has had his finger on the pulse of this electoral realignment in a way that Democrats haven't, but other Republicans hadn't either, right? He somehow either, I don't know that he understood it so much as he just came along at the right time, right? Yeah. He just was benefited from it. But, you know, political scientists look back, right? There were these, you know, major sort of political realignments that have happened in American history in the past, right? Whether it was, you know, in the second half of the 20th century with like Southern Democrats and, you know, the sort of Republican Party and Nixon using the Southern strategy, whether it was, you know, prior to that was the Democrats put together the sort of New Deal coalition. So these moments happen, and it feels like that's what's happening now as well. It's surprising to me. You and I talked a lot over the past 10 years, and I saw, like, what I saw happening in the early era of Trump was what felt like the breakdown of the Republican coalition that's been in place and in power for 50 years, right? Because the Republicans in Donald Trump's first administration had control of the House and they just were unable to do anything, right? And despite all of that, despite it looking like we were watching kind of the implosion of the Republican Party, what's happened is he's managed to sort of get everybody on board, or even Republicans, you know, traditional Republicans have sort of come around to this new kind of nationalist, populist agenda. And the Democrats are left kind of in the wake, right? So now I think there's something that is sort of unpredictable about this moment, right? There will be a shift, right? There will have to be some sort of realignment of voters and of party affiliations. What's unclear to me is what is that winning coalition for the Democrats? I think that's what they have to be thinking about, is about, like, it's less about, it's always about the issues, right? But it's about finding the group of people that you can get on board based on the issues that you support in order to sort of get you across the finish line to win these elections. And I feel like Democrats have been so focused on, like, we are right, that they often aren't focusing on, like, how do we win, right? And it's unfortunate. Like, you don't want to have to prioritize winning over being right, but being right and always out of power isn't a particularly effective way to achieve your goals either. Right.
Well, I think this is such an important point here, because you're right. The polling, on most issues shows that the Democratic position is more popular. And you and I have talked about this again for years. Mm-hmm. But what has been really smart, or what the Republicans, specifically what Trump has been done, is he's drawn a big distinction between campaigning and governing. And I think what he's been very good at is campaigning and finding a couple issues, trans rights and immigration, and then just hammering those populist issues to death because he knows they're popular. They're popular globally, right? There's this movement of sort of these anti-immigrant movements around the world, especially in the advanced developed democracies. And he's feeding off that bigotry to great electoral success. Now, on the other side, his governance is a bunch of garbage, right? I mean, we just talked about the big, beautiful bill. That's not a populist piece of legislation. That is not thinking about middle class people. That's not thinking about poor people. That's not thinking about the major issues of inequality or climate or all these real issues, women's health rights that he said he was going to address. No, that's a huge tax cut for the rich. Basically very, very little for the poor. But it doesn't matter because he has created this political environment where all that matters is the campaign. And that's what he does. He's not governing. He's continuing to campaign. He's hired a cabinet that goes out in campaigns rather than governing. You know, when that the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, came out and gave that speech where he was attacking the media this week, that wasn't him governing. That was him campaigning, right? So they've created this dynamic where the Democrats, I think, have to shift focus because they win on the issues, but they're losing the campaigns. And I think for me, I think that's a good starting point.
What do you think? Because I agree with you. I think that there's all sorts of compounding factors here, right? Because like there's the whole Fox News thing, right? You've got this whole element of America that only gets their news from one source that tells you that the Democrats are evil. And that's a huge thing to overcome, right? That's a part of the reason why Donald Trump can say populist things and enact the exact opposite of that. Yeah. Because, you know, you've done away with the idea of truth. It's a major uphill battle in a lot of different ways. But yeah, I feel like my tendency is to think that this whole like should the Democrats focus on like economic issues, economic like working class, economic populism, or should they focus on sort of marginalized communities, minorities, you know, rights of, you know, that sort of approach. It feels like a false dichotomy to me, right? It feels like Democrats, if you take party labels off of it and talk to the American people, Democrats tend to win on economic issues across the board, right? You go back, going back 50 years almost at this point, when a Democrat is in power in the White House, the economy does better. The people feel better about the economy. Yeah. When then Republicans take over and the economy craps out and the people feel bad about the economy and then a Democrat comes. So all this stuff points to, you know, the idea that the policy approach, the economic policy approach is right. And it feels like if you can win on that, you can also enact policies that are beneficial to minorities. But maybe the issue is it's figuring out what the issue is that you campaign on, right? What you push for. And I know for so many Democrats, it feels wrong to not be pushing for, you know, sort of marginalized rights at the forefront. But again, it's the idea of you do what you do to win so that you can enact policies that are beneficial to people. And it's oftentimes the case that these, whether we're talking about civil rights broadly, but, you know, anytime you're sort of expanding rights, the population often lags behind the actual sort of shifts in sort of legal issues in politics. And so, yeah, I mean, part of it is that, you know, maybe there's something, maybe Bernie Sanders is onto something, right? Yeah. Economic populism doesn't have to be bad, right? Populism can be harnessed in a way that is pro-democratic and pro, you know, that is, you know, effective in positive ways. And there's no doubt that American politics could use, you know, some element of, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of corruption and all sorts of other stuff in politics that Democrats could benefit off of in terms of like policy steps. So I don't, I mean, so I guess you were saying you don't have any answers, but I'm still putting it back to you. Like, what do you think is the answer?
Here's what I would say. I think at some point you have to solve problems, right? Yeah. And I think, you know, Donald Trump keeps kicking the can forward, and that's a great strategy. if you don't want to run for re-election or if you're planning on carrying out a coup of some sort. But if you want to get elected 4 years, three, 4 years from now, the public is going to want some results. And I think his strategy, there's an emptiness to the governing side. So I think the Democratic candidates need to talk about issues, but they need to do it in a better way. I mean, you can't have these long lectures. And I think about candidates, you know, last week we talked about Zohran Mamdani. What are the things that he's so exciting about him is that he's young, he's dynamic, and he can explain these issues. He can make complicated issues simple for the average person. I think about, you know, going to Tim Walz, the vice presidential candidate. One of the things that he was so good was being an advocate for Democratic positions.
Yep.
Going out there and saying, no, it's important that we provide school lunches, and this is why. I would like to see the Democrats do more of that, but the delivery matters maybe more than anything. Donald Trump is really good at delivering a particular message and staying on that. Democrats easily drift into this sort of elitism and overly complicated issues. I think you in some ways you need like a Bill Clinton. You know, yep. They always talked about him as the explainer in chief. You've got to find ways of connecting with people on a messaging, because I think at the end of the day, obviously the issues matter, but if you can't persuade people of their importance, you know, if you've got guys like you and I, like, no, we're the eggheads, Phil. They don't want us doing this. They want somebody who they can connect with, who they identify with. So the vessel and the you know, who's delivering that message matters so, so much. Because I think you're right. They're going to win on the issues and the policy. But how you deliver that message is so important in today's political environment.
It does feel like the Democrats have spent a lot of time preaching to the choir, right? Like, they're talking to you and I, and you and I are we're not who they need to be talking to, right? And so that's the challenge. And part of that is, I think, and this is, you know, David Brooks makes this in, you know, conservative, but he makes this argument that essentially that to some extent, like, the Democrats have to be willing to sort of push back against some of their own base and constituency, right? And this is the notion of, I mean, to some extent, this is kind of what we've been saying, which is, you know, the old idea that perfect is the enemy of good, right? Like that the idea that we can't, you know, if we can't, you know, be perfect in our legislation or our push for whatever it is, green energy you know, immigrant rights or whatever, then, you know, it's better to be, you know, right than to win. Right. And at some point you have to be decided it's also important to win, right? You've got to be willing to compromise on some of these issues. Yeah, I mean, I think the messaging thing is perfect, right? Because I look back at Joe Biden, right? So the stuff that, you know, all the evidence is he was good for the economy, even though somehow the American people didn't. He was great for the economy, even though, you know, worldwide, America did better than anybody else, right? He passed these massive bills that sort of invested in infrastructure and all of this. And I think that's an example of the messaging issue, excuse me. Part of it is, you know, the branding of it as essentially kind of this huge green energy bill is a good example of you're achieving this, but you also, just by calling it that, have turned off a huge chunk of the population, right? And so there was not enough, it feels like, focus and emphasis on the job creation. I mean, they talked about the job creation, but that should have been the focus overall from the beginning, right? And there's other aspects too, which is where I think Democrats have to be more aggressive about doing stuff in the short term. And that feels counterintuitive, right? Investing in green energy and all of this stuff is this long-term investment, and it's really important. But there's all sorts of evidence that, like, none of, like, the benefits of most of that aren't being realized until Donald Trump is president, right? And so some of it has to be, like, you've got to do stuff that makes life better for people today, not just changing laws that will make things better in 10 years. You got to do that too, but you got to be able to do something right now. You got to be able to explain to people how they are better off now than they were 6 months ago because of what you did.
No, that's absolutely right. It's such an important point. The messaging has to be consistent and immediate. And I think one of the other factors that you and I have been kicking around the last couple of weeks is the challenge of doing so in an era where there is sort of this nationalism and populism and all of that. And this is, you mentioned the Anne Applebaum piece. And one of the things that I think she does such a nice job fleshing out is she's looking at what's going on in Poland. And that Poland, for many years, the Law and Justice Party, this far right, right nationalist party controlled things, was slowly undermining the democracy. And then they were able to pull power away temporarily from law and justice. But as she noted, those voices are still out there, and mm-hmm. they're still making these sort of populist nationalist, you know, religious right-wing nationalist claims. And we have to acknowledge they work. They work yep. so well. And you can't ignore them. And where Donald Trump and others are going to go in response is going to make these anti-immigrant, make these nationalism complaints, the white national, all of that stuff is going to be here. And so Democrats have to think about that messaging as well. This sort of ugly stuff that makes us, you know, cringe when he does it, you know, constantly going after trans rights and all of that. That stuff's not going away. And you got to counter that as well, especially in an era where as climate and as globalization changes, there are going to be more immigrants. You're going to have a more diverse population. How do you address those ugly arguments in your own political system?
Yep. Well, and I think that's where it's you've got to be able to push back against those. But in order to push back against those, you also have to have credibility with the yep. people you're trying to persuade. Right.
And
so,
yeah,
that, you know, David Brooks talks about the Democratic Party needs to re-embrace. I think he talks about flag, faith and family. Right. And yeah. And what he means by that is probably different than what I would mean by it. But I think there's some truth to that. Right. Like, I think for a long time, the Democrats, you know, you see this, right? Like, where weirdly, we've gotten to this point where like the American flag is like, if somebody's flying an American flag or wearing an American flag, yeah. you assume they're a conservative, right? So some of it is like re-embracing that nationalism, but you're doing it in a way that is, you know, a positive form as opposed to what you want to push back against. And the other part, I think, is coming to terms with the world, there is this huge populist shift right now. And I think there's this tendency to push. And again, populism can be awful, right? Like, this is Donald yeah. Trump's, like, the breakdown when it's anti-democratic populism, that's all sorts of problematic. But there can also be, you know, pro-democratic populism. And I think there's a lot of argument that is essentially in the populist family that the Democrats have been making for a long time. If they're just willing to embrace it, right? So much about like the critiques of the election system, of, you know, all the stuff we talk about, like reforming yeah. the election system, reforming the filibuster, all of that could be framed as populism, right? Like, what we need is we need to quit allowing these yahoos in Washington to do all of this stuff, right? Like, there can be an anti-Trump, anti-Republican, anti, you know, that pro-working class populism that's actually in line with the Democratic Party if they're willing to sort of embrace it and make those arguments. And I do think there's a lot of younger Democrats who are sort of doing that, right? And so that's the other part, is that the Democratic Party has to wrestle with their age problem, which is, yeah. you know, that even more than the Republican Party. They are this, you know, really old, you know, in terms of, not in yeah. terms of their voting base, in terms of their representatives, right, are yep. really too old and need to, like, embrace this generational shift.
It's so important. And yeah, this is, and Brooks also talks about this as well, that this is a moment, and I'm trying to remember who he was interviewing, but he was talking about that when you enter a revolutionary moment, and that's where we're at, right? Donald Trump and the global populist movement has created this revolutionary movement in politics. And when you enter a revolution, there isn't just one bit of change, right? Everybody yeah. has to change. And that creates some space for the Democrats also to grapple with big ideas. Yeah. And it doesn't mean throw away the old agenda, but you think about repackaging it. That's why, again, Zohran Mamdani, I think, is such an interesting choice for New Yorkers, because he's an open democratic socialist. Yeah. He's young, he's dynamic, he's thoughtful, right? I am curious to see how he governs and how he runs his sort of political system as well. Because those may be some really, really interesting ideas. And I think Democrats should embrace a lot of them. You know, let Bernie and AOC do their thing. Let's just see this Democratic experiment. But Democrats should swing big. If we come back and say the choice is really finding that space between Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden, that's really where we got. No, that's nope. You're going to lose, and you're going to lose for the next decade. Right. You have to think about how do we, you know, in some ways it's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity, right? What have you been talking yeah. about for a lot of years? How do you go about governing in a more dramatic way? And was it Rahm Emanuel who said, never let a crisis go to waste? That's sort of where the Democratic Party is right now. And they can either try to, you know, triangulate this tiny little centrist position or think big about what do you really believe in?
Which is where having, again, back to the Joe Biden debate, right? Having yeah. had, if we had, if he had stepped aside and there had been this kind of open primary, you could have begun that process a right. little bit of different people yeah. sort of challenge playing these ideas. And that, that will be the interesting thing to see moving forward, how that plays out. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's, to some extent, this is the idea of like, you have to begin by sort of recognizing that the old model is, this is the notion of like when there's this huge revolution and this huge shift in how people are thinking, the first thing you have to do is sort of recognize that the old model's gone, right? Like, yeah. I think that's the tendency is to want to hold on to, you know, again, like we need another Barack Obama or we need another yeah, Bill Clinton. Right. When in fact, the reality is like, that's gone, right? The old model of yep. doing things of how the Democrats won, the first thing you have to do is sort of let go of that. And then you can sort of look forward to, all right, how do we move forward? Who can we get on board that's in line? Which policy issues are the most important to us? And how do we build a coalition around that? And to some extent, that's the heart of this debate about which policy issues are most important. Are they the economic ones? Are they the sort of identity, you know, ones? But even more important than that is what comes after that, which is like, how do you build a coalition around that in a way that you know, can get a majority of people to support you. Yeah. How do you make, you know, compromises and deals and build a coalition? That's what coalition building is, right? It's based on compromise and negotiation.
And if you look at like one of the New York Times pieces kind of broke down Trump's victory, and you look at the, I don't know if it was county level, the number of counties that drifted Trump, it was overwhelming, right? So the problem for Democrats
they only look at counties that shifted yeah. three elections in a row. So it's not just like in the last election. It's like over the past 12 years, these
yes.
huge amount of counties that have shifted dramatically towards Donald Trump, towards the Republican Party.
And that should be a wake-up call, right? To your point, you can't keep saying the same messaging. You've got to think big about that messaging and also how you deliver that messaging. And then also think about the reality of the Senate, right? If you really want to govern, you've got to be able to control these institutions. And so you've got to find a way. And it's, again, if you look at the Senate map, it's really, really difficult for Democrats to make inroads there. So what do you got to do? You got to rethink about how do we connect with people all over the country? How do you find a way to connect with voters in Iowa, with Democratic messaging? I don't think it's impossible, but I don't think you go out there with Nancy Pelosi or Joe Biden again and you're, right. you're going to win it, right? You have to think bigger about how do you connect with people on a human level, break some of this sort of partisan divide, which I know is really, really difficult, but I think there's space for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's this whole notion that comes up over and over again. I think the Brooks piece mentions that several of the others do that, like, the American people think the United States is in a bad place and is going yeah. in a bad direction, right? And so that's where the one thing when you look back at, you know, Barack Obama or whatever, was that ability to convince people, get people excited about, hopeful about the future, right? And that's... You know, all the looking backwards, all of the stuff that even you and I were talking about, right? That Democrats are better yeah. on these issues and Democrats have issues that, like, that's great. But at some point, you know, like you gotta, it doesn't matter if more people like your policies, if more people don't vote for you or if yeah. they don't realize that your policy. So, yes, that right. messaging is so important. And how they're going to do that moving forward.
And one thing we've learned from populist politicians is they're very bad at governing. They're good at messaging. They're good at undermining democracy. They're bad at solving problems. And we yeah. saw this in COVID. We've seen this in a whole host of areas across the, whether it's foreign policy, domestic policy. So you know Democrats are going to have an opportunity. These things that Trump is pursuing now are not going to be widely popular. They're not going to solve a lot of problems. So there is going to be a space for you to step in and say, we can do a better job. You just got to be ready for that moment because there's no doubt, Phil, it's coming, right? This is all of what we're watching now. You know, the later, you know, alligator Alcatraz, these sort of policies, eventually people are going to be like, these are sort of dumb policies. And you got to be willing to come in with better ideas and better messaging to address that.
Yeah, it feels like there's a lot of room to basically agree with, like, to come in, there's a Democrat, there's an opening for a Democrat or someone to come in and basically say Donald Trump is right on so much stuff, right? On on his critiques of, you know, whatever, the economic inequality and the system is rigged and all of these other things, right? But his solutions are disastrous, right? And so you want change. Let's bring about change, but let's bring about change in a way that is actually helpful to the working class as opposed to, you know, the people who are the top 10% who are benefiting from Trump's tax cuts.
Right. Because Trump is good at that messaging. Yep. He connected with a lot of people. And now the question is, you know, these policies are not going to reflect some of that. Although, again, it's not easy because he's good at the messaging. He'll keep doing executive orders. He'll keep hammering the immigration stuff, the trans rights, all of that stuff. So Democrats have to be well positioned to confront all of those issues. And again, I'm more hopeful than I was maybe a month ago, seeing some candidates. I mean, whether we're talking about Pete Buttigieg, who seems to be, I mean, I don't know what his long term success will be, but he's confronting the issues on the face, like, you know, offering real conversations. Mamdani is a smart, thoughtful guy who can do some of that. So there are these candidates out there wherever they fall on the ideological spectrum. I'd like to see more of that from the Democratic Party.
I like how we began this conversation by basically saying we have no idea what the answer is. And then we spent like 30 minutes talking about what we think the answer is.
This is one of the things we think through the issues. And sometimes that process leads us to certainty. So, well, that's probably a good place to wrap up. Phil, why don't you remind everybody how they can stay connected with us?
Yeah, so you can go to thepoliticslab.com. If you go there and click on this week's link on the homepage there, I'll have that David Brooks piece. There's an Ann Applebaum piece about the sort of persistence of the kind of nationalist populist movement around the world. A link to that New York Times article that breaks down these huge shifts that have happened over the last three elections. And then there's another, we didn't even get into all of the, a little bit of the implications on that SCOTUS decision for immigration. What happens to, you know, people who are born in the United States in a place where birthright citizenship is not granted? So there's some weird, problematic loopholes in there. So anyway, all of that will be linked at thepoliticslab.com.
That is wonderful. And just a reminder to our listeners that we won't have an episode next week, but we will be back in 2 weeks. And Phil will tell us all about his adventures in Alaska. So I will see you in 2 weeks, Phil.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.